It's Lynn Rossetto Casper, and you're listening to The Splendid Table, the show for people who love to eat. Our program is produced by American Public Media and brought to you by Super Target. Well, today it's Grilling with the Mavericks. Our guest, Dan Huntley, tracked the country's free thinkers of the backyard grill, the visionaries who see beyond the Weber. They build their own cookers with things like tin cans, 39 Chevys, or even shopping carts. Dan's book is Extreme Barbecue, Smokin' Rigs and Real Good Recipes. We meet up with the king of bling, Liberace. Now, he was the 50s superstar who played himself and excess to the hilt. And evidently, he cooked the same way. Then it's Malaysia's street hawker's heaven, the food stalls of Penang. And as always, in the second half of the show, we're going to be opening the lines for your calls. You can reach us at 800-537-5252. So let's roll with those experts of sleeves-up cuisine, Jane and Michael Stern. They write the Road Food column in Gourmet magazine.
And, you know, one of the road food rules that we have always followed is if you see a lot of people wearing clerical collars and clergy eating at a restaurant, it usually is almost as good as if the cops or firemen are eating there. So at Nisi's Soul Food Restaurant in Kansas City, Missouri, we had the best breakfast, and we were probably the only people in the booths who were not preachers.
Was this a highly spiritual moment?
Well, it was highly spiritual once the food arrived, because the food at Nisi's is really, really good. We did not join the pastors in prayer, but when the food came, we thanked God for how delicious it was. This is one of those soul food treasures that you find in some of those Midwestern cities that where you get a lot of types of food that you really don't find in too many other restaurants.
Like chicken and waffles for breakfast
yes.
and lunch. And you kind of pour syrup and butter over the waffle, and you have grits with it. And it's one of those dishes you can have for breakfast, lunch, or dinner, or all of the above.
Right. And also, we had fried pork chops. Let me tell you, you know, in terms of breakfast meats, we were there for breakfast. And ham is good. Bacon is good. Sausage
right.
is good. Fried pork chops are the end. I mean, they are the greatest.
It was a pig epiphany.
It
the only thing
like
that was a little weird was we had pig ears.
A little weird, Jane?
You know, this is one of these stern masochistic things that we hate pig ears, but whatever we – whenever
I don't hate pig ears.
Oh, you don't?
No, I don't like to eat them, but I don't hate
well,
pig
I
ears
like them on a pig.
Okay.
I don't like them
right.
to eat. But we always order them, I think, just to marvel at – how strange they are. But Nisi's is a good place for pig ears.
Well, the great thing about the pig ear sandwich at Nisi's is that you don't just get a single ear in a sandwich. When you order a pig ear sandwich, Myra C., the waitress who had a little badge on her uniform saying she had been there 19 years, said, you don't just get one, you get two ears in every sandwich.
Okay, but on to things that we like.
What about desserts? What are the desserts like?
We had a great cobbler there, but to be honest, Lynn, we had so many chicken and waffles and pancakes and country ham and eggs and grits that in a very unstern-like moment, we did not scarf up a bunch of desserts.
I couldn't understand why. Now, where is this in Kansas City?
It's not a place we have ever been to. I can't describe where it is in Kansas
it's
City.
Primarily, it's primarily a black neighborhood, and there are a number of soul food cafes there, but Nisi's is the famous one, and it's been there since 1985, I believe.
Yes, Denise Griffin Ward started it in 1985. And as I said, Myra C., our waitress, has been there 19 years. And she's one of those waitresses who just, you know, you walk in and you feel so taken care of from the moment you sit down. She makes sure that your food is nice. You order the right thing. You get the right side dishes. Your iced tea, which of course is nice and sweet, is refilled when it needs to be. It's just, you know, you walk in and you are set for the meal.
It's the kind of place that's also sort of a community center as well as a restaurant. Okay. And when we're on the road, you know, you sometimes feel very disconnected and you get homesick. And a place like Nisi's just kind of, you know, fills you spiritually as well as culinarily.
I think all those reverse collars would probably be very reassuring.
They are.
Hey, guys,
they're
thank
wonderful.
You.
You're welcome.
Bye, Liv.
Going to Kansas City. Kansas City, here I come. To Kansas City, Kansas City, here I come.
Dana Michael Stern's latest book is Road Food Sandwiches. Now, the Sterns check in with us here every week, but you can get their food finds anytime you want. Just go to the website, splendidtable.org. Before Elvis, before Elton John, before Prince, there was Liberace, the classical pianist turned world's most flamboyant performer. His Las Vegas shows sold out for years. His sense of over-the-top kitsch played out in his costumes, in his home, and now we find out in his kitchen. Karen Fetter is a Hollywood costume designer and a restorer at the costume archives of the Las Vegas Liberace Museum. She's also co-author of Joy of Liberace, Retro Recipes from America's Kitschiest Kitchen. Karen, welcome.
Thank you, Lynn.
Well, you know, Karen, the first sentence in your introduction to the book, and this is the quote, "Never underestimate a man in a sequined apron." Were you a Liberace fan to begin with?
I knew of Liberace. I'm very much into costumes and costume design. So when I recently moved here to this city, the Liberace Museum was one of my first stops. I have never seen in person a performance of Liberace's, but I was always a fan of his costumes.
You have to describe them.
Oh, yeah. They're so wonderful and over the top. He always had a matching cape with his costumes, and often that cape could weigh 200 pounds. It was 100% bejeweled and befurred and befeathered, besequined. And often he would come on stage with a accompanying car, a car that matched the costume because the cape was so heavy. Mm-hmm. So he would roll on stage in the car that also had like rhinestones and feathers on it. And he would step out of the car and he would make a few twirls to show the audience the inside and the outside of the cape. He would drop the cape and underneath the cape would be another more extravagant costume that he would wear for a few minutes during the performance, and then he would change his costumes a lot. And often he would use not rhinestones but real diamonds in his costumes. Like we have at the museum a display of buttons that are made out of diamonds that spell out his name.
Oh, my goodness. I didn't realize he was using real stuff on those things.
Yeah, real stuff. He was just, he did everything as over the top as he could for his audience. He always said, well, people expect this of me and I have to top myself from my last performance. So things just got bigger and bigger and bigger.
But, you know, I think the thing people didn't know about him is that he liked to cook.
Yes, he had really always been into cooking ever since he was very young. When he was in high school, he inaugurated in his school a chef course. So he loved cooking even back then. His mother was a professional cook. She worked in a cookie factory to support them when they were growing up. Mm-hmm. And he so loved cooking that he would travel with his own cooking utensils. He had specially made cases for the utensils. And when he would arrive at the hotel, he would request that the hotel provide a refrigerator and hot plate. And he would set these things up in the bathroom on a board over the tub. And so then he could cook for whatever friends were in town, wherever he was, and the crew and family. And this was very important to him. And he did this throughout his entire career in every city.
So where are the recipes in this book from?
A lot of the recipes were passed down from his mother. And a lot of them are his own recipes that have been tweaked over the years. Mm-hmm. And they're all, I just love this collection of recipes because they're all so mid-century. 1950s recipes where, you know, it seems like every dish was, there was a Jell-O mold and red meat and hard liquor involved.
Can you describe some of them, though? Give us an idea of what his food was like.
Yes, he, well, I don't think Liberace ever met a cup of cream that he didn't want existing in a recipe. Every recipe, and even if that recipe already had olive oil and butter and cheese in it, a cup of cream could make it even better. So they're really pretty heavy recipes. There's a lot of meat. There's a wonderful recipe for braised oxtails, which is, you know, something we don't eat very often today, but which was classic in its era. There's a wonderful sweet potato recipe, and this is what recipe where, you know, not only is there sugar in their recipe, but then you put marshmallows on top of the sweet potatoes. And my favorite recipe is, I call it the secret weapon casserole. And the secret weapon in this casserole is squid.
Squid?
Squid.
Well, you know, he was pretty daring be serving squid back then, especially.
Absolutely.
You know what I'm dying to know about? What did his tables look like? Were his tables sort of the way he dressed himself?
Oh, absolutely. We have at the museum a collection of his place settings, china and stemware crystal, that numbers over 1,000 pieces. And that's just what's left after he's gone. There were a number of things that were sold at auction when he died. And so he always had the best of the best. He spent whatever he had to. There's a great story. He traveled to London, England, and he performed for Queen Elizabeth II, and he was able to dine with her. And he fell in love with her crystal stemware and asked, could I please replicate this? And she said, okay. And so the royal glassmakers made him his own special set of her custom stemware. And we have that at the museum. So yeah, over the top, money wasn't an issue for Liberace. He was the highest paid pianist in his era. In Las Vegas, he was the highest paid performer during the 50s for many years. He opened at the Riviera, 1955, and was paid $50,000 a week, which was a huge amount of money at that point in time. And he collected antiques, so he has a lot of his place settings were, very authentic and wonderful vintage pieces.
I guess a paper plate never entered his life.
I don't think he would have enjoyed that. It just wouldn't have been fun.
Hey, Karen, thank you.
You're very welcome.
Every time I play that little part, it seems to bring out something out of certain people in the audience. And I bet if I played it again, you'd all like to try it. So I'm going to play it again. Go ahead, try it. Live dangerously.
Karen Feder is co-author of The Joy of Liberace: Retro Recipes from America's Kitschiest Kitchen. She left us with a much-needed seasonal recipe, Liberace's own, and I'm quoting here, in Italian, zucchini means zucchini. And you can find it on the website, splendidtable.org. And while you're there, sign up for our e-newsletter, Weeknight Kitchen. This is all about quick worknight recipes. You get a new one each week, along with tips and information that I deem priceless. Weeknight Kitchen's free, so sign up. splendidtable.org. Coming up, the guys who grill on junkyard serendipity and the Attila the Hun of the vegetable garden. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from American Public Media. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is The Splendid Table, the show about life's appetites. The Splendid Table is brought to you by Archer Farms Foods, from organic spinach and feta pizza to parmesan and garlic potato chips. You can find Archer Farms flavor pairings for every palate at SuperTarget. There's a league of outdoor cooks who believe that picking up a Weber at the local home store is for sissies. They do a kind of grilling that we barely get a glimpse of unless we're lucky enough to be in the right place at the right time. This grilling goes by other names: contraption cooking, junkyard serendipity. Now, what I'm talking about are the home-built cooking rigs created by the tinkerers among us. Dan Huntley is a North Carolina newspaper columnist and a barbecue judge who has co-authored a book. It's called Extreme Barbecue: Smoke and Rigs and Real Good Recipes. Dan, welcome.
Glad to be here, Lynn.
So, Dan, what drew you to this? I mean, was it the actual cooking contraptions or was it the people?
It was a combination of both. Over the years, I'd seen a variety of cookers, oyster steamers, fish fryers, hog cookers, and I used to judge barbecue contests. And during that process, I became more interested in the people and the cookers, and I just started focusing more on these crazier rigs, the unique one-of-a-kind. And what I found was that the people, the cookers, were pretty much a match with the uniqueness of their rigs that they were cooking on.
What kind of range are we talking about here? Can you give us a picture of the extremes?
I met a woman. We were talking about different types of cooking, and she said to me, she says, I bet I can cook a chicken on a piece of string. And I said, no, you can't. And sure enough, it goes back to colonial America, where they would truss a chicken on a piece of string, hang it from a nail in front of a fireplace, and then to get it to roast evenly, you would just twist the chicken at the bottom. And then, I began to understand that this concept of meat, metal, and fire has been around for a long, long time. It started, with Native Americans cooking fish over green limb grids over fires, and continues to today with people with obscenely expensive rigs out of stainless steel and brass and all that stuff.
But the kind of people you talk about aren't going out and buying it ready-made. They're making it themselves.
Right.
Tell me about some of these people. I mean, who stands out in your mind?
There's a couple people. One of my favorites is Carol Robinson in York, South Carolina. He uses old motorcycle parts, lawnmower parts. he used an old wood stove connected to a fuel oil heating tank, and had a separate wood stove on the side, and then you draw the smoke across the rig, and the floor of the cooker he used from a walkway that he found from some abandoned industrial site.
So what do you cook on something like this?
Well, on that particular rig, Lynn, we can cook a whole hog up to about 200 pounds. I've done 20 whole salmon on it. there's not much I can't cook on that one.
So, okay.
It weighs about 2 tons. It's got lights on it now, so I can take it on the highway and things like that.
It rolls?
Right. Oh, the only money that we've got in this thing is about $115, and that was for the two tires and the axle. Everything else was scrap. And, I've probably cooked 200 hogs on this thing. It's indestructible. It's a Sherman tank,
Amazing. Who else?
One of my favorite rigs is a guy outside of Kansas City. His name is Mark Shapiro. he runs a motorcycle shop, and he started with a motorcycle trailer, and then he got an old pizza oven and a beer keg, and he kind of married these things together, and it's the oddest looking rig. I mean, if you saw it, you wouldn't even know it was a cooker. But, I mean, he's won, $10,000 in prize money with that, and it's loony, but one of the things that I learned early on in this process, Lynn, was that, you could have novelty cookers, but how does the meat taste on the tongue? And we found some pretty crazy rigs out there, but we had to end up eliminating them because they just didn't know how to cook.
How about some simple things? I mean, who's doing stuff that maybe is a little more doable for most of us?
Well, one of my favorites is the Whitener brothers down in Blacksburg, South Carolina. They wanted to have an oyster roast in December to feed a bunch of people, and they didn't have a rig, so they ended up taking these galvanized trash cans, and they set them over cinder blocks, and then they have like a propane burner under there, and then you take a bushel of oysters, put it in a croaker sack or a burlap sack, and you put about a gallon of water in the bottom of the trash can, and then you put the sack inside of the trash can, but raised up off of the water.
Right.
And then you just put the trash can lid on it. And, I mean, the first time I came up on one of these rigs, I mean, it was like this amateur rocket launching or something. I mean, I saw all these gleaming trash cans and what I thought was smoke, but it was steam coming out the sides of it. And, it just works. It's cheap, it's effective, and, they got about $25 in a rig.
It's just like putting a big pan on the stove and steaming a lobster or steaming the oysters.
Right.
You've got this one, the man from Oaxaca, Mexico, who does the barbecue, and he just digs a hole in the backyard.
Yeah. He's one of my, the first guys we interviewed, Maximino Rios, who lives outside of Charlotte. And he's recently moved here from Mexico. And in his family, I mean, this tradition goes back in the Mayan culture. I mean, it goes back 10,000 years where they would dig a pit, two or three feet wide, two or three feet deep, and line it with a stone. And then they would build a fire in the base of it. And then they would put volcanic rock on top of that to kind of collapse the fire. But also they're heating the rocks. And then they would take the goat or lamb, whatever they were cooking, the barbacoa, and they would wrap it in banana leaves.
Right.
Here, he couldn't get those, so he uses just heavy-duty tinfoil. And you wait till the fire goes down, put the meat on top of the hot rocks, then you put like a big board over the hole, and you mound about 2 or 3 feet of dirt over it to further insulate it. And so what cooks it is not the coals, it's the heated rock. So you effectively, you're steaming the meat. Had no smoke. I mean, in fact, I was teasing him about, you know, where do you get the smoke? And he says, I'm trying to keep the smoke out. He says, we don't want smoke. The smoke that they introduce is from the chipotles.
Chilies, smoked hot chilies.
Right. And again, it's just a difference in culture. And I thought it was fascinating with this guy, Maximino, this hunger for home and that, you know, he could have a shiny stove from Sears. But what he wanted was to dig a hole in the ground in this suburban neighborhood and cook the way his grandfather cooked. And he says this takes him home.
Hey, Dan, thank you.
Glad to be here.
Dan Huntley is co-author of Extreme Barbecue, Smokin' Rigs, and Real Good Recipes. Now, Dan left us with a prize-winning recipe for beef brisket from the guy who had the grill that was made from the pizza oven. Now, this is a Feed the Masses recipe, so save it for a party. You're going to find Pyro's Burnt Ends on the website, splendidtable.org. The summer vegetable garden has been romanced to a fare thee well. You can pick up any magazine right now and you'll see recipe spreads showing gardeners grinning over their baskets that are overflowing with what the copy tells us are the sun-drenched blessings of Mother Nature. And when the Klieg lights go out, I think some of them might sound like one of our favorite gardeners, writer Scott Hewler.
We hear so many paeans to the gifts of the garden. And I'm not immune to such love poetry myself. This season alone, we've eaten crisp snap beans right off the vine and tomatoes with juice still warm from the sun. A volunteer tree provides a bounty of pears whose fruit, even on the hottest day, yields juice cool and plentiful enough to quench your thirst. Yet we forget that this harvest cornucopia of earthy gifts resembles in some ways our other annual gift-giving frenzy. Like grandparents of an only child, the garden doesn't always know when to quit with the presents. Those first tomatoes inspire eye-rolling ecstasy, but by week four of the tomato harvest, with lopsided red orbs lining every windowsill and even the birds ignoring the factory seconds, the thought of another tomato sandwich of toast, mayonnaise, and salt causes eyes to roll with quite another emotion. That first bunch of kale was wonderful, but after only a few bunches, kale turns out to be kale. The garden lacks discretion, giving gifts whether we want them or not. 'Tis the season, it shouts, and we plaster another smile on our face and try to be polite. Which brings up zucchini. The zucchini is the fruitcake of the summer garden, the universal unwanted gift, the symbol of the earth's thick-headed unwillingness to see reason. Oh, did I give you 2 bushels of these last week? The garden says, arriving at the door, then shrugging. Well, here are some more. You can make salad. No, you can't make salad. You've already had as much zucchini salad as you care to. You have grilled them and baked them, stewed them and chopped them, and fried them in oil and Old Bay, yet more zucchinis keep coming. Zucchinis fill bushel baskets under the sink and in the shed. Zucchinis end up stacked like cordwood by the side of the garden. You have given them away. You have left baskets on the doorsteps of friends, ringing the doorbell and running away under cover of night. I have been to parties where the hostess had a bushel of zucchinis to offer as guest gifts, only to have guests arrive bearing zucchinis as hostess gifts. You want to talk about grins frozen on faces. Every year, its early results raise hopes, and every year the zucchini market crashes like the Hindenburg. Raising zucchini is like raising dandelions. The problem isn't getting them to grow. The problem is getting rid of them. Which is why this year, our Raleigh garden has to be considered the site of a zucchini miracle. Tomatoes, spices, beans, fruit, even a watermelon vine, everything grows in my wife's garden. My wife has a thumb so green that all she had to do was move in, and a butterfly bush in my yard that had remained the size of your head for 10 years suddenly grew to the size of a tractor. She waters, and sunflowers grow to the height of NBA players. She digs, and muscular vegetables and flowers pop out of the ground like toast, flinging aside impediments like pebbles, sticks, sundials. Even during this year of drought, our garden produces. with one miraculous exception. There in the front are two zucchini vines, one still hanging on, a faded orange blossom like a feeble smile. The other hopeless, its last green leaves withering to yellow. My wife stares sadly down at them, but I rejoice. Everyone from green friends to our CSA farmer has loaded us up with zucchini. It's that time of year, and nothing can be done. The zucchinis are upon us. I'm just glad for once not to be part of the problem. Anyhow, not part of that problem. Anybody want some pears?
Writer Scott Hewler is author of Defining the Wind. Now, the big question after listening to Scott is, does the world need another zucchini recipe? Well, considering that they multiply like rabbits, I figured another recipe couldn't hurt. Now, for me, you grow zucchini for the flowers. So you can get my recipe for crisp fried zucchini flowers on the website, splendidtable.org. If you want to know how people really eat in a country, try their street food. Now, some of the best in the world is found in Asia, and one of the most sought-after street food scenes for people in the know is Malaysia, especially the city of Penang. Finding the best stir-fried noodles, spicy soup, or flatbread is an obsession for tourists and locals. Reporter Maria Bacalopoulou brought us a report on why Penang has earned the reputation as the food hawker's paradise of Asia.
To Ong Ting Ong, the owner of the Shing King Ong restaurant off of Love Lane, food means everything. The eatery, first opened by his father in 1941, is set in an old Chinese shop house with blue stained glass windows.
They have such a stern regard for food. They wouldn't let you order more than what we've ordered. If we order in excess, he'll tell you, you can't finish, so please don't order. So to him, his food reigns supreme.
Z, the author of Penang Passion, a cookbook highlighting the city's bounty, is helping me navigate this tremendous food scene here in Penang. Nothing can prepare your taste buds for this flavor overload. With each mouthful, you can taste the imprints of all the ethnic communities, from Chinese, Malay, Thai, and Indian, that have left their culinary mark here. Transplanted from Singapore 16 years ago, Z has been food-obsessed ever since.
When I first got here, I just couldn't get used to the fact that you can start a serious argument with someone just by bringing the subject of food up, you know. And before one meal is actually finished, they're actually planning for the next. So it's not surprising to find that Penang nights actually snack in between, you know, eating every 2 hours.
It's like a pastime.
It's a pastime, it's a national sport. It's also a way to, you know, satisfy a certain urge, you know, just to find a way to de-stress. I, for instance, to de-stress, I'll hit my favorite laksa stall. And then after that, I'll be like, okay, relax. I'm ready to, face the day again.
And so we did. Z and I hopped into her car and went to find this aphrodisiac in a bowl known as laksa. Unlike other laksa dishes in the region, Penang's Assam laksa is a sour tamarind fish-based soup that merges Chinese and Malay influences. With shredded fish, cucumber, onions, fresh mint leaves, pineapple chunks, and ginger buds mixed with soft rice noodles and the tang of a sweet prawn paste broth, your senses tingle to life.
It's delicious.
It smells very fragrant.
Mm-hmm. You do seem much happier all of a sudden.
Yeah, you're right. See? Laksa does give me a lift. I don't know why. No poppy seed, no opium, I assure you. You finish a bowl yourself.
Yes.
What? I actually feel euphoric too.
I think it's the element of the heat. Like it makes you hot and it cools you off at the same time, and it's just this sort of intense flavor experience.
The choices you have to make when you wake up in Penang. Do I want Chinese, Malay, or even Western food? Today the winner was Malay, and a fight it was in true Penang style. Getting in line to snag a piece of curry fish or black sauce chicken was a real mission. No one made eye contact in line at this food stall. It was a survival of the quickest. 60-year-old Lau B. Ibrahim opened her successful food stall more than four decades ago.
Because of my problem in my marriage, start business, small business on the roadside to support my family.
And how did you get the money to start up your business?
I borrowed from a friend, from a moneylender actually. And then I started there during recession time, so business wasn't so good.
Things are much different now. On an average lunch rush, 800 customers line up for her tangy signature dishes.
In Penang especially, most people, they don't go for big restaurants. They prefer a hawker stall. When a hawker stall, you can make more than restaurant. Restaurant overhead is very high.
Stall owners like Lau B. Ibrahim guard their recipes and work long hours to make the dishes themselves.
Curry kepala ikan, fish curry, and then ayam hitam, the black sauce chicken, and then udang besar, masak rempah, big prawns, and then this cuttlefish, sotong berempah, the big fish from the wholesale market. Early in the morning, I woke up at 4 a.m. and drive down there to purchase things from on the other side of the island.
Every day?
Yes, every day.
Sitting back in my chair, feeling full and satisfied, all I can think about is what is next. So begins the addictive cycle that possesses anyone who comes to Penang. It is a city obsessed with flavors that over-intoxicate the senses. As I walk through a cluster of food stalls, I too think there must be a better laksa or char kway teow, a favorite fried flat noodle topped with prawn. And so I go local, give my stomach a two-hour rest, and get back out there, and drive whatever distance to get to the next food stall, whatever it takes to get my next fix.
Reporter Maria Bakalapalo is based in Indonesia. Well, it's time for this week's trivia challenge. Now, the question is, if you want an everlasting life, what fruit should you be buried with? We'll have that answer in a moment, and we'll be opening the lines for your calls. You can get to us at 800-537-5252. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from American Public Media. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is The Splendid Table, the show for people who love to eat. The Splendid Table is brought to you by SuperTarget. It's Target, now available in food. At SuperTarget, you can find the foods and ingredients for your favorite recipes, plus the things you need to serve it up all in one stop. Well, we're going to be opening the lines for your calls in a moment. The number's 800-537-5252. But first, I've got the answer to this week's trivia challenge. Now, the question was, if you want an everlasting life, what fruit should you be buried with? The answer is peaches. In China, peaches are the symbol of a long life and of immortality. Chinese poets and philosophers believed eating peaches on birthdays ensured long life, and to be buried with peaches brought everlasting life. One story I heard is that the Queen Mother of the West, back in 110 BC, took peaches from her tree to the emperor. Now, the magic here was that the fruit would ripen once every 3,000 years, and whoever ate it would be immortal, which they would have to be to wait that long.
Color, darling, I know who you are. Some above your color, child.
Okay, it's time for your calls. Pick up that phone. The number's 800-537-5252, and we will talk. Okay, let's get rolling. We have got Roy on the phone from Greenwood, South Carolina. Hey, Roy, what do you want to talk about?
I do a lot of cooking. It's a hobby of mine, but my wife is more than happy to let me cook. And I'm just trying to figure out some way to kind of take my skills up a notch. And I guess I'm wondering if there are some good books or classes I should take to kind of help me. I'm kind of like on the fringe of gourmet, but I don't think I'm actually, a gourmet cook yet. So I'm really wondering, there's so many cooking terms I just don't know that, how do I move to the next level?
Oh, I see what you mean. Yeah, it's a great question because I think a lot of us, we get into something and we're really interested in it. And then you reach kind of a point where you say, it's sort of like learning a language, but you didn't learn the grammar.
Oh, exactly.
Yeah. And you suddenly realize I have to figure out what all of this is about. What form does it take? Tell me, what kinds of things do you like to do? What kinds of things do you like to cook?
Well, I learned how to make sushi. That was a blast.
That's pretty neat.
My wife complains I don't do that often enough. A lot of my dishes, I lean a lot toward Italian, mm-hmm. and I seem to kind of take Italian and I fuse it with, Chinese food. I might do kind of Italian stir fry.
Right.
I have some recipes that I've kind of, being a mad scientist cook type, that I've put together. And I just really want to kind of take it up to the next level. It's funny, but like last Christmas, I got cookware for Christmas.
Right.
And a chef's apron because I just cook so much. And it's like a stress relief when I get home from work. It's a great way to just kind of release,
Yeah, it's the same for me. In spite of the fact that I live and breathe it as my profession, when I go into that kitchen at night where I don't have to write it down, I may never make it again. But everything goes away. It's just you and that stove and the pleasure of sitting down with your family. It's really great. But okay, enough of the warm fuzzies. Let's talk practical stuff. I think what might be helpful is to learn the basics, like what is a sauté? Because a sauté, once you know what it is, you could do a Chinese sauté, you could do a Moroccan sauté, you could do a Cuban sauté, but you've got that basic technique down and also what to look out for, how to control it, how to correct something that goes wrong. And you learn each one of those techniques. You learn how to do a stew. You learn how to do, something like a boiled dinner, but the basic techniques. And there's a couple of places you might want to go. Now, there's a new book out, considering you have the mad scientist streak, which I have also. I think one you might really enjoy because she gives you the basics and then she gives you the possibilities. And you've probably heard her on the show, Sally Schneider, Improvisational Cook. Her stuff has a lightness to it, an elegance to it, but it also can be really gutsy at the same time. So that's one book. Take a look at it. See if it speaks to you.
Okay.
I think the other thing, and this gets really detailed, but boy, it's about technique and it gives you a lot of power, is to look at Cook's Illustrated magazine. You may even want to subscribe to it. Now, they have a basic cookbook that they've done. It's all from the magazine. But have you ever seen Cook's Illustrated?
I haven't.
Okay, it's a magazine. It's on the newsstands, and you can go online and find it too. And what Cook's does is they'll take a recipe. Let's say they'll take cornbread, and they'll try to find the best recipe for cornbread. But in the process, they will explain to you all the science and all the things that they tried that worked and didn't work. So that's another place to go. Look at Cook's Illustrated. They've got a long list of cookbooks too, but just subscribing to the magazine. That way, every month, I think it comes out 6 times a year. I never remember, but you get it regularly and you can give it, you can say, okay, I think for this month, I'm going to try doing this technique a couple of different ways to make different dishes. So you're getting the why of the recipe, not just the how of it. And then the other thing is, one of the great books of food science, and trust me, all of this does come down to science, is by Shirley Currier, and it's called Cookwise. And it's a recipe book that she then explains the science behind the recipes. It may have the all-time greatest biscuit recipe in the entire world, but it has a lot of good, solid dishes. But it has dishes, and she cooks like nobody else because she's a scientist. It's not hard. In fact, it's easy. But the reality is that once you've got Shirley's information down, you can take, you know, her stir fry and you can put anything you want in it, because you know how to do a stir fry. So I would say look at The Improvisational Cook, look at Cook's Illustrated Magazine, and look at Cookwise, and see what you think about those.
Great, thank
you. All right, and enjoy, Roy. Don't lose the mad scientist piece. It's really important. Okay, bye.
Bye.
You can call us 800-537-5252. We have Michelle calling from Camarillo, California. Michelle, welcome. What do you want to talk about?
Hi, Lynn. I'm hoping that you can help my husband and me with a big culinary decision we have to make.
What is the big culinary decision?
Well, we are getting ready to upgrade from our six-year-old rickety starter grill.
Right.
And we don't know what to get. And the decision was hard enough with all the different makes and models of grills. But then a couple of weeks ago, we attended a barbecue where all of the food, everything from succulent bacon-wrapped giant scallops with sage butter to just good old-fashioned fall-off-the-bone barbecue ribs, had been cooked in a smoker. And the flavors were incredible, and now we're totally lost. So I'm calling you because my husband is a man who loves to eat, and your show is for him, and he and I both adore your show. So to grill or to smoke, Lynn, that is the question. What should we do?
Oh, boy, oh, boy, oh, boy, oh, boy. Do you want a charcoal grill or you want a gas grill?
Well, we had a gas grill.
Okay. I know this is more work, and I know it's more mess, but a charcoal grill, because you can use real wood in it,
okay,
is so neat. Rather than go into brand names, let's talk about the liability and the positive and the negative, okay?
Okay.
If you get a smoker that only smokes, that's all you can do. But if you get one of those kettle grills, you know, like Weber or that kind of thing,
uh-huh,
and get a big one. Because
so the kind I grew up watching my dad empty out?
Yeah, exactly. But, you know, they have them now that you can empty them out through the bottom.
Oh, okay.
I just got a new one. And the reality is you can smoke in those babies.
Oh.
Yeah, you know, they're egg-shaped, and you can smoke in them. And you can have the option of just doing straight grilling or smoking. And they come both in gas and in charcoal. But one of the keys to me is I see people go out and they get like the little 14-inch, and then one day they decide they want to do a rack of ribs. And they discover the rack of ribs is like, you know, 20 inches long, and you can't fit it on the grill. So get as large as you're comfortable with. The round ones generally run around 22 inches. But I would go with the grill, because the grill, especially a kettle style, you still have the option of the smoking. And the other thing is that if you get a gas grill, look for one that really gets to very, very high temperatures. So those
okay.
are that, that think large, think that it goes to high heat, and realize that you want something you can smoke with. And gas grills, you can do that too. But I wouldn't go just for a smoker, because that limits you.
So what would we ask for if we were looking for the convenience of the gas grill but wanted the smoking capability? What would we...
I think what you'd want... You know what I think you're going to do? This is what I think you should do.
Okay.
Go into a bookstore and check out a book called How to Grill by Stephen Reichlin. Because he has in the back of the book an entire discussion of exactly what to look for and what to ask for.
Okay. But you'd encourage us to get the charcoal.
You know, that's me. I mean, look, but you're also talking to a woman who wants to cook like a cave person. You know,
That's my husband.
Yeah, well, you know, I mean, my husband thinks I'm crazy because it is more work and you have to wait for it to get hot and all that other business. But I do charcoal and I do wood in it, and it's wonderful. You know, real wood. I can cook over real wood. So this is the cave person talking.
And Stephen Reichlin's book talks about doing that as well,
you
putting wood
got
in,
it. Yeah.
in the charcoal
and
grills.
I think it's one of the best discussions I've seen anywhere.
Excellent. Well, thank you so much.
You are welcome. And thanks for listening to the show. Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Take care. You can reach us at 800-537-5252. Better food through technology. Sounds like an ad for genetic modification or some kind of Frankentech. Well, Daniel Barber has a different take. He's a chef and co-owner of New York City's Blue Hill Restaurant and Blue Hill at Stone Barns, which is up in the countryside in New York State. He's author of an article that appeared in Food & Wine magazine. It was called Creating Flavor in the Field. Daniel, welcome.
Hi, how are you? Thank you for having me.
Well, Daniel, I want to know, what do you mean by this creating flavor in the field?
Well, the practicing is sustainable agriculture and a sort of farm-to-fork philosophy. One of the problems that gets associated with this kind of setup is that you tend to have this impression that the farm needs to be a throwback to a simpler time to be pure.
Yeah.
In other words,
yeah.
To be this real kind of old sustainable farm, it needs to be practicing agriculture that was around, 100 years ago. And in fact, we're not, a Shaker village at the turn of the century. We're a real working farm in 2007, and we're trying to take advantage of the latest innovations and technologies that are out there.
Well, you talk in the article about examples of new technology that are being used by farmers these days. Can you give us some of those examples?
Yeah, one of them is a device that has been around for a long time called the refractometer. Now, a refractometer today is used quite a bit in the wine industry to measure basically the sugar content of a given plant.
Uh-huh.
So if they can measure the parts per billion of sugar and know when to pick the grapes more accurately.
Right.
But it's increasingly being used by farmers because it allows them to test the soil for, say, carrots and know when to do the picking for the carrots. What it really does is give you a standard for when to pick. And you could do that also by tasting, but what the refractometer does is measures what you're already tasting very accurately, and it gives you a scientific understanding of your levels that then can enable you to become a better farmer. You know, the next year we'll know what to shoot for, and we can manipulate the conditions to try and get to that number, and that's something that allows us to be more consistent with what we harvest.
There's the use of ultrasound with grass-fed livestock.
Right. Ultrasound's been around since the 1960s. But what has happened in the industry, whether it's the pork industry or the beef industry, is that, the concentration of the feed has been, corn-based over the last 30 years in ways that we've never seen. And that's allowed the animal to take on a lot of fat very efficiently. Efficiently sort of in quotes, because it efficiently in terms of pure weight gain and efficiency, ecological efficiency, and all the rest. Grass-based agriculture, which is really something that predominated before World War II, tends to harvest animals that can be perceived anyway as having less fat. It takes a lot more time for them to gain the kind of fat and marbleization that you're looking for. And what a ultrasound does is before you go to slaughter, it allows you to test and see what your marbleization is like. So you can take a look at where your herd or your stock of animals is going, and you can then either change feeding techniques or rotational techniques over the long term, or breed for better marbleization for the future. So again, it's a scientific tool that allows you to be more precise in the field and therefore create better flavor on the plate.
And you do consider both of these to be essentially sustainable?
Yeah, sustainable in this sense, it's a little bit of convoluted thinking, but it's only to make, a stronger point, which mm-hmm. is that, it's sustainable in the sense that I think it makes me a better chef. So that's there in itself is my motivation. I mean, there are a lot of people who, come to the farm and care little about the flavor that we're producing in the kitchen, and much more just about the ecological benefits of and the fact that we're preserving this open space 28 miles from Manhattan. So that's fantastic. But there's a lot of other people who really don't. That's not their way into this issue, and their way into this issue is through better flavor. And that's a significant amount of people. And so every night we serve, on average about 150 people,
mm-hmm.
150 guests, and that's 150 opportunities to argue for a kind of agriculture that's better for us, better for our environment, and tastier.
Well, Daniel Barber, thanks for talking with us.
Thank you.
Daniel Barber is chef and co-owner of New York City's Blue Hill Restaurant and Blue Hill at Stone Barns in New York State. His article, Creating Flavor in the Field, appeared in the July 2007 issue of Food & Wine magazine. Well, that's the show for this week. Thanks for joining us, and call us anytime. 800-537-5252. Have a great week, and until next time, let me leave you with this thought from Russell Baker. He said, "Ah, summer, what power you have to make us suffer and like it." Splendid Table is produced by American Public Media and brought to you by SuperTarget. Now, everything you heard here today, as well as solutions for all sorts of dilemmas, can be found on our website, splendidtable.org. And while you're there, go for the free stuff. Sign up for our weekly e-newsletter, Weeknight Kitchen. It's our solution to your weeknight suppers. And for our podcast of the entire show. It's all there, splendidtable.org. Despite all obstacles, this show has been produced by Sally Swift and Jennifer Russell with intern help from Andrew Schumacher. Our technical director is Jennifer Lubkin. Our website is managed by Judy Graham and Jeff Harkness. Have a great week, and please join us next time. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper.
American Public Media.